Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Hey, thanks for tuning into the Shame Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. I've got a very interesting topic tonight and a very esteemed guest. Tonight we're talking about God and your brain. So here to talk to us about his brand new book is Dr. Andrew Newberg. He's the director for the Center for Spirituality and the Mind at the University of Pennsylvania. He's one of the founders of new interdisciplinary field called neurotheology. He's an associate professor in the Department of Radiology with appointments in the Departments of Psychiatry and Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania again. And his work has been featured on a lot of television shows. We've got Good Morning America, Nightline, the BBC, National Public Radio, and National Geographic Television. He's the co-author of several books here before this one. We've got Why God Won't Go Away, Born to Believe, and The Mystical Mind. So tonight he's going to be talking to us about his brand new book called How God Changes Your Brain. Welcome to the show, Dr. Newberg.
Thank you for having me on your program.
No problem. Now, do you prefer to be called Dr. Newberg or Andrew or Andy? What's your preference there?
We can be informal. You can call me Andy.
Okay, awesome. Anybody who's a neuroscientist, it's kind of, you know, that's such an awesome title. I feel like I have to address you formally.
Oh, no, that's okay. We're pretty informal around here these days.
Well, can I ask you, I mean, it sounds like you've got a pretty interdisciplinary approach to spirituality, but I'm just wondering if you could share a little bit with us about your own personal journey, why this topic obviously is of great interest to you if you're repeatedly writing about it.
Sure. Well, it's really been something that I've been interested in since I was a child. I think I was always asking a lot of the big questions and trying to understand why we're here and how we know what's reality. And it was actually always particularly concerning to me how there could be so many different religions and political groups and so forth that all looked at the world, looked at presumably the same world, but looked at it in very different ways. And that was very difficult for me to really grasp and try to understand that. And so as I went through my education, I certainly was very interested in science as a way of unlocking the mysteries of the universe and was very interested in going into medicine as a career, so I pursued a lot of those kinds of classes in biology and chemistry and so forth. And as I got into college, I was really confronting a lot of those questions. I began to take a lot of courses in philosophy and religious studies, trying to get a sense as to what all the different perspectives really were, because I guess at that point I really hadn't known exactly what everyone was thinking about. So it was very helpful for me to see all these different perspectives. And it was also about that time that I guess in my own thinking about these questions, I grew kind of more intensely aware of what these issues were and spent more and more of my time trying to resolve them in my own mind. And as I did this, it became a very inward kind of process. It became something that was much more contemplative for me. It was meditative, if you will. And that was kind of combined with starting to learn about Buddhism and Hindu thought, really kind of opened my eyes to a much more enriching way of looking at the world that not only utilized science, which I still held in high regard and still do today, but also understanding the importance of the spiritual paths that people have taken and the philosophical pursuits that people have taken at trying to answer these big questions. And then finally, I guess the last piece of the puzzle was when I was in medical school and had the great fortune of meeting up with a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania who has since passed away. But he and I started working together back in the early 1990s, really trying to explore the intersection between science and religion as it pertained to the human mind. So we started to think about what were the areas of the brain that were involved when people meditated or prayed, or when we were involved in different rituals. And from there, we grew a whole series of studies where we actually scan the brains of people, and we can talk about this later in the program, but scan the brains of people when they were engaged in practices like meditation and prayer and speaking in tongues and so forth. And that's really led us up to the present day. So to me, I'm still on this journey. I'm still trying to learn more, and I'm still trying to understand it more. But I've kind of come to the conclusion that we really have to use both the best of what science has to offer and also the best of what religious and spiritual pursuits have to offer. And that's kind of how I got to looking at this intersection and looking at this integrated way of trying to understand ourselves, trying to understand how we relate to reality.
Well, if I can, just back up a little bit.
Sure.
Did you come from a religious family by chance, or spiritually based family?
Well, I came from a Reformed Jewish household, and so we were we celebrated as many people do, kind of the main holidays of the religion, and we certainly had a sense of a belief in God, but the rest was really something for us to think about and question about and to wrestle with, if you will. So for me, it was always an environment where I felt very encouraged to ask questions, and it was a very open environment to challenge what people believed, both in Judaism as well as other religious traditions. And so I kind of grew up with a sense of spirituality, but I also had a sense of the importance, the deep importance of asking lots of questions and really challenging any particular idea or belief system. And that's, I guess, how I ultimately grew up. But it was a great way for me because I do have, I feel like I always need to have a lot of freedom in my ability to ask questions and to explore things.
So it doesn't sound like your parents would have been necessarily upset that you explored Buddhism and Hinduism.
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, my father and I, we always chuckle about all those times back when I was a kid, and you know, way past my bedtime, I come wandering into to his study, and you know, at 11 o'clock at night, and get into these whole philosophical debates with him.
And, how old were you?
Oh, I probably ranged anywhere from about 8 or 9 up till, you know, when I was in high school. So it probably got a little bit more sophisticated as I got older, but.
Go ahead.
One of the things that was very important, I think, and also has been an important part of my own pursuit here, is trying to understand not only the esoteric elements of it, but how it becomes practical. And that's always been a part of my work, and it's a big part of this new book about how God changes your brain. Is on one hand, we look at what that means and how does belief in God change your brain, but we also offer a lot of practical applications about how people can do different types of practices, meditation and prayer, and make it a practical part of their lives as well. So it's always important, I think, and my father instilled in that in me a long time ago, that it was important to kind of look at both sides as well.
Well, you mentioned, you know, getting to college and entertaining philosophical ideas, and I'm wondering if you, I'm sure you're familiar with René Descartes.
One of my favorite.
Yeah, well, you know, I got to tell you something. When I was 15, I had never heard of René Descartes, and I was sitting there contemplating this whole, you know, how do you know what's real and what you can believe in? And I think maybe for me it was because I had very super religious relatives on every side of the family who were kind of vying for control over my soul, you know? So, and my dad did encourage, not unlike your father, encourage questioning because he wasn't really sure.
Right.
But I finally came to the conclusion that I did exist because I was having thought processes.
Right.
And then shortly after that, I came to the conclusion that God existed because I sensed an entity outside of myself that I could dialogue with.
Sure.
But it's interesting because by the time I got to college and read about Descartes, you know, that was very similar to what his path was. You know, I think, therefore I am.
Right. Well, and actually, I mean, one of the things that I think is unfortunate sometimes is that I think sometimes people have actually, Descartes' always been one of my favorites, and I think unfortunately sometimes people and maybe this is my interpretation of his work, but when he actually made that comment about I think therefore I am, it was really, I don't think it was a philosophical statement. I think it was in many ways a deep mystical kind of statement. I think in the depths of his meditations, and that's where he said it in his philosophical meditation, is where he came to that. And I think so many times, which is always the case in the world and history, that we tend to interpret through our own lens, and we sometimes forget where that person was at that particular moment in time. And I think so many times we kind of look at it from this analytical perspective of, well, what was he saying, instead of what was he really feeling viscerally and what was he experiencing. And I think in many ways, just like your own experience, it was probably a very deep, spiritual, mystical kind of experience that had a profound influence on him and has had a profound influence on many other people.
I found it painful because, I mean, if you're really authentically pursuing that line of thought and that spiritual exploration, then you have to live in this space of unknowing for quite some time. And it's amazing how attached we are to our beliefs.
Absolutely, and it is it can be extraordinarily difficult. And I agree with you. I mean, for me as well, as I really got into the depth of some of those questions, it was extraordinarily difficult and painful, and I was very distraught at times trying to resolve some of these issues. And in fact, I mean, one of the things that I have been very interested in terms of the study of religious and spiritual experiences, we live in a society today which tends to like to look at things from a more positive side in general, and so many times we think about the positive effects of religion and spirituality on people. There's been a lot of research and studies that have shown the benefits of religious and spiritual beliefs on mental health and physical health and so forth. And I think to some extent that there's a fairly decent amount of studies which support that. On the other hand, there are, as you said, I mean, there are the very strong negative experiences that can happen to people. And I think it's equally important to try to understand them, try to understand how we might be able to help individuals who are dealing with those kinds of religious and spiritual struggles, existential struggles, why and how different people come through that to help ultimately guide other people through that process, because it can be extremely difficult at times. And of course, in the end, hopefully it is something that fosters growth and creates a person who has a great deal of compassion and understanding for others. But obviously, again, sometimes people really turn into a very negative, hateful, exclusive kind of perspective on the world. And we spend a lot of time in our own research trying to think about that and trying to understand that. And I certainly hope at some point we'll be able to do more explicit studies on what that negative side actually is and how it comes about.
Well, you mentioned Buddhism, obviously. And my understanding of Buddhism, I've studied a little bit. It doesn't profess a belief in a higher entity such as God.
Right. That's right.
Am I thinking about that?
In terms of your own experiences, or?
Well, just the books that I've read and the people that I've known who are Buddhists don't usually profess a belief in God.
God, no, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely correct. And in fact, one of the topics that we've dealt with a lot in our research has been the concept of atheism and what exactly that means, because you can be an atheist and be a complete materialist, that the world is the way it is, science is going to answer all the questions that we need to know, and everything else, philosophy, ideology, theology, whatever, spirituality, that's all completely irrelevant. You could be like a Buddhist who is non-theistic. They don't necessarily believe in God per se, but they may have a deep sense of spirituality. They may have a deep sense of how they connect to the universe, how they connect to other beings in the universe. They have often a sense of perhaps an absolute reality or a universal consciousness, if you will, that can be in many ways has a certain parallel to what we would believe in the Jewish or Christian type of perspective, but nonetheless is in many ways fundamentally different. And again, one of the studies that we talk a lot about in our book is this survey of spiritual experiences that we've been running. It's an online survey, and it's absolutely remarkable the diversity of what people describe as their spiritual experiences. And for some it's God, but for some it's a force, for some it's an energy, for some it's just a consciousness. So there are, and as you mentioned earlier, for some it's enormously positive, but also for some it's extraordinarily negative and scary. So these are some of the things that we have yet to really understand and learn, and this is what we're trying to do.
So when you talk about how God changes your brain, do you include in that, say, Buddhist practices that don't actually, they're spiritual, but they're not usually God-centric? Or have you found a difference that people who actually believe in a God that has a distinct personality separate from theirs have got more health benefits than someone who believes in this nebulous, whatever, we're all going to go into the ether and we just have to be good while we're here? Any differences between those belief systems? Or?
Well, we probably don't have enough data to really say absolutely one way or another. What most of the information that we have, I think, really shows us is that it has, at the moment, what we have found is that from a biological perspective, what matters, I think, the most is what kind of a practice somebody is doing. What exactly are they doing with their mind? Are they focusing on a God? Are they focusing on an object? Are they focusing on just trying to clear their mind or empty their mind? And depending on what one does, in that regard, we do tend to see differences in the brain. We do tend to see, for example, that the areas that are involved in focusing the mind, if you are engaged in prayer, if you are engaged in a meditation practice where you're focusing on something, regardless of what that something is, then you activate the parts of the brain that are involved in helping us to focus attention. On the other hand, we did a study that to me was just fascinating, which was on speaking in tongues. And when people are speaking in tongues and they feel that they have sort of surrendered themselves over to the Spirit of God, then those attention-focusing parts of the brain shut down and turn off. So it may have more to do, at least biologically, based on what the person is actually doing and the general aspects of what they experience. Now, that being said, what I think is important to also say is that the more one engages your mind in the practice, the better it ultimately is for you. So, for example, if I gave you a Buddhist meditation practice and you started to do it, but you really didn't, you know, get it, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense to you, you know, you might experience a little bit of benefit just because you're doing this practice. But if I said to you, okay, what's your religious background, and gave you a prayer that was specific to that, and you focused on that, and it made sense within your religious background and your spiritual background, then that really engages your whole mind and makes it a so much more powerful kind of experience and practice, and has a much more profound effect on you.
So, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it sounds like you're saying that it's not so important what kind of a afterlife or entity superpower you believe in, but that you have a spiritual practice.
Well, from a biological perspective, there is a certain truth to what you just said, that it tends to be more related to what you practice. However, there is, in terms of what you're talking about, one of the things that we have also reflected on and have started to do some work with is that it does depend perhaps on the emotional content of what you're looking at. So if you are focusing on God, and if you focus on God as a loving, caring, involved God in your life, then that can turn you into a very positive, warm, loving, forgiving kind of person. If you focus on God as a God to be feared, a God who can be easily angered, who does not easily forgive, then you're more likely to wind up activating the parts of your brain that are involved in fear and anxiety and exclusivity, and lead you down a path in which you wind up fostering a lot of negative emotions, hatred, anger, and so forth, and lack of forgiveness. So it does depend on part on the practices that you do, but it does depend also on what is the specific content. So if it is just a kind of floating around, you might feel a great sense of peace, but you may or may not necessarily have better interrelationships with other people because you don't have this personal relationship with that thing. If you are talking about a personal relationship with God and you feel that, and you feel that that's an important part of your life to have a relationship not only with God but with the other people in your life, then that's going to foster that kind of an experience and that kind of behavior. So it's multifaceted, and it's hard to say something, you know, that it's, you know, a very simple answer, but it does depend now. And of course, this is all based on a scientific evaluation, on a biological analysis. So to say that what you believe in is not relevant, that may be the case in the context of doing an MRI study, but it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with a theological question or a philosophical question. There may very well be ideas and concepts which are better and worse and more important than others, and that, of course, is something that's debatable on that kind of a level, not necessarily on a scientific one.
Well, yeah, I would think on a scientific level it would be very exciting to find out. Is there a difference, for instance, between somebody who has a meditation practice and someone who simply goes to church?
Right. Well, these are some of the questions. I mean, that's a great question, and we don't really know that. I mean, we have done some studies where we've looked. The closest I've come to that kind of a question is a study in which we've looked at the brains of people who are long-term meditators, who have done various spiritual practices for a very long time. And this actually, by meditation, it did include Buddhists, it included nuns. So it was kind of a catch-all of all the people that we studied. And when we look at the baseline functioning of their brain and compared it to other people who were just healthy individuals who did not specifically do any kind of deep, heavy spiritual practice, there were a lot of significant differences in their brain. So there is something that's fundamentally different about somebody who is a deeply religious or spiritual person. But the big question that we don't know is whether or not their brains were always built that way, and that's why they became such a spiritual person, or whether or not, you know, it became that way over time because they've been doing prayer and all these kinds of practices for a long time. And I ultimately suspect that it's a little bit of both, and actually in our new book, we're actually starting to do these kinds of studies where we take people who have never really done this kind of a practice, we start them on the practice, and then we try to see how it changes their brain over time. And in fact, it does tend to have an effect on the brain in the same areas that we see in the expert meditators and the people who are highly proficient in their spiritual practices. So,
give me an example of the type of differences. We're not going to say changes because we don't know what's causal here. But
right. Well,
what kind of differences are you finding between the healthy person who doesn't have a spiritual life and the healthy person who does have a spiritual life? What kind of differences in the brain?
Of course. Well, I think two of the most important changes are if we do look at the brain, the two most important differences that we've seen, I think, one is in the frontal lobe. So this is right behind the forehead, and we see that the frontal lobe is much more active in people who have been deeply involved in these practices. Now, that makes a lot of sense because this is a part of the brain that is turned on whenever we focus our mind, whenever we focus our attention on something. So if they spend large portions of their life, large portions of their day, heavily focused on God, on meditation, then we would expect those areas of the brain to be more active and more energized, if you will. Now, it's also interesting that the frontal lobe is also very important in our emotional responses, and in fact, it helps to regulate our emotional responses. And it also, there's a lot of evidence to support the fact that parts of the frontal lobe are involved in giving us the positive emotions that we have. So it may be that the frontal lobes help to foster a sense of compassion and forgiveness and love. So if we encourage and engage those parts of the brain and expand and enhance their function, then it might make sense that we create, that the person creates within themselves a much deeper sense of compassion and warmth and love, for example.
Hmm.
Now, so that in and of itself is very interesting. And then the other area of the brain that we have found some significant differences in is a part of the brain called the thalamus. And this is a very central structure in the brain. It sits right in the middle of the brain. And it has
the hypothalamus?
It's just above that. Yep, exactly.
Okay.
And in fact, we might want to, when we start talking a little bit more about the actual sort of physiology of some of the peak experiences and how they may relate to sexual and mating behavior and so forth, that the hypothalamus, as you just mentioned, actually, I think, becomes even more involved. But for the moment, let's just talk
about
the thalamus.
That little part of the brain that rats will push a lever to stimulate and starve themselves to death.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And it's also
sex is more important than food.
Exactly. Exactly. So, but we'll talk about that. But the thalamus is a very key relay in the brain. It helps to connect different parts of the brain, and it also regulates almost all of our sensory information as it gets up into the brain. And what we find in people who are long-term meditators, long-term spiritual people, that as with many parts of the brain, there's kind of a left and a right side. So in the people who are these deeply spiritual individuals, we find that one side of that thalamus is much more active than the other. There's what we call an asymmetry. One side is more active than the other. Compared to the general public, where people generally have pretty equal activity in both sides. Now, the problem is that on one hand, it's a fascinating observation, but we don't know exactly what it means. But we can speculate that because this area is involved in our sensory information and allowing all the different parts of the brain to connect with each other, that it may be really, it may lie at the essence of our perceptions of reality and how we make sense of the sensory environment that's around us and try to reconstruct a sense of what that reality is for us. So it may be that they actually alter the biology of their brain in terms of how it actually peers out on the world and understands the reality that's out there. So we see these two very fundamental changes in the brain that occur, or differences that occur, between spiritual people and those who do not profess to have any advanced practices. So, that's why we're, one of the things that we really wanted to get into in this most recent book on how God changes your brain is to try to see where those long-term changes are, those long-term effects are. And what we are seeing in individuals who we start down a meditation path, for example, is that they do start to change the activity in their frontal lobes, and they do start to change the activity in their thalamus, as well as several other areas. But we are seeing that it changes them, and it also changes their emotional state, as well as even their ability as in terms of how they think. It actually improves their memory and their cognitive powers and so forth.
Meditation improves your memory.
That's what some of our early studies have actually started to show, that when we actually started off people, older individuals, on just a very simple 15-minute-a-day meditation practice, that when they came back 8 weeks later, their memory had improved by about 10 to 15%, depending on what kind of measure that you use. So, we're still in the process of trying to see one of the questions that you asked before. I mean, does that mean that one meditation is better than others? How do we start to look at all that? And of course, we're going to have to wait for more research to really understand it. But there do seem to be improvements, so that's very exciting. And they seem to be related to the changes that we see in the brain.
Amazing. I'm going to check in with our listeners here for just a minute and remind you all, if you're listening live, you can call in and ask Dr. Newberg a question yourself. Otherwise, you're just going to have to listen to me ask him questions and hope I ask the ones you want. Our toll-free number here is 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. I understand we've got a little busy signal when you come on, so don't let that drive you away. Just hang on. It's looking for an available line, and then you'll get connected. If you don't want to pick up the phone, you're welcome to Skype. You can contact me directly at Veronica Monet. That's M-O-N-E-T, just like Claude Monet, Veronica Monet on Skype. And you can also Twitter me. Again, my ID on Twitter is the same, Veronica Monet. I look forward to hearing from you. I have a question for you, Andy. It has to do with the idea of where do we think this comes from? So as a scientist, I'm assuming that you believe that human development happens within the context of life here on planet Earth, and I don't know if you believe in evolution or not, but that there might be some relationship between humans and animals and brain function across the across those genetic barriers or in those, in between species. Do you think that we have any at least precursors to a spiritual life in the animal world?
We have certainly thought about that, and actually, for me, I think at the moment it's too early to tell, based on what we know scientifically, exactly how religion and spirituality got into the brain. And we can talk about some of the types of changes that you're talking about, the evolutionary the potential evolutionary basis for these kinds of experiences and so forth. Of course, if somebody's, if you're religious or spiritual, then it also makes sense that it's in our brain. Of course, it would make sense that God would put these functions and these processes in our brain. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense. You know, for why we would have no way of being able to have a connection with God if it wasn't a part of us to begin with.
Uh-huh.
But getting back to your question about the possible evolutionary basis of these feelings and so forth, this is actually some of the work that my mentor who passed away, I mentioned a little earlier in the program, was really what he was looking at. And he was starting by looking at the different parts of the brain as they evolved in different species, and in particularly in the development of human beings, that if you look at the size of our brain and the different parts of the brain, particularly the frontal lobes that we were talking about a few minutes ago, and another part of the brain called the parietal lobes, which are located towards the back top part of the brain, these are parts of the brain that exist in virtually every mammal species, and they tend to serve similar kinds of functions. Now, the first evidence that we have of any kind of religious or spiritual behavior in human beings, you have to go back about 100,000 years to Neanderthal, where we start to at least see some evidence of burials with different things, trinkets and so forth, and necklaces and flowers that went along with the person, at least some idea that there was an afterlife. And it is about that time, at least, again, from a purely evolutionary perspective, that we believe that's when some of the larger parts of our human brain, the frontal lobes and the parietal lobes, really came online. And before that, we really don't see those areas of the brain being at the level of complexity and size that they are today. To some degree, it may require, at least for the expression of religious and spiritual practices, a brain that is about as complex as what we have. And if we do look around us, we don't see any clear evidence of animals expressing religious or spiritual beliefs. Now, that doesn't mean they don't have them. It just may mean that we can't, you know, we don't see it obviously. But where my late colleague really tried to tie this together with animals was in the context of rituals. And rituals are a very, very important element in religious and spiritual practices. They pertain to any kind of rhythmic behavior or rhythmic activity that engenders a deep sense of connectedness and a sense of oneness, and really entrains the entire brain in some sort of common idea and common goal. Rituals are incredibly important and powerful in religious and spiritual pursuits. And you can certainly see that in the context of the Mass, in the context of different religious holidays and ceremonies. And this repetitive aspect occurs across multiple levels. So you may say the same prayer over and over again. You may say it at the same time within a particular ceremony, and the ceremony may be repeated on a daily, monthly, yearly, or even generational basis. And it's those rituals that become an incredibly powerful force that enable people to grasp and understand these religious and spiritual ideas. Now, you turn to the animal world, where do we see rituals? Rituals occur primarily in the context of mating. And what happens in mating? Well, the whole idea is to bring a connection. It's to bring two animals together in a way that they normally wouldn't get together. So for some sort of common purpose. So, and all of the rhythmic activity that goes into mating rituals, all the way up to the sexual act itself, they create a huge amount of changes in the brain in a lot of the same areas that we see religious and spiritual rituals changing in the brain.
Oh, this is fascinating. This is very fascinating. And actually, now, have you linked this to any of the historical evidence that human beings actually first started having religion around sex?
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that is, you know, should be very obvious, I hope, to most people is the rather complex relationship between religion and sex. And sometimes it has been a very positive relationship. And as you said, there are many religious and spiritual traditions which have embraced sexuality as being an important part of spirituality. On the other hand, particularly in some of the Judeo-Christian context, sometimes sexuality is viewed as kind of the competitor. It is a feeling which sort of interferes with our ability to truly grasp the religious or spiritual side of things. So, but either way, I think it's fascinating because it shows that there is this deep link between sexuality and spirituality, and is something that I think also has not been explored nearly to the extent that it should be. But I do hope that more and more we will be able to see what that true relationship is, because I think it's going to be a very close one.
Yes, I don't know if you've heard of the book Transcendent Sex by Dr. Jenny Wade. She documents some amazing transformative spiritual sexual experiences in lay people, not people that have studied meditation or tantra or anything like that, just ordinary people who got together to have sex and something happened. And
yeah.
For some of those people, it was just a peak experience that really left an impression on them, and for other people, it literally transformed their entire life. You know,
makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, something so spiritual happened during the act of sex that they changed the entire course of their life.
Well, I mean, it's not surprising, and we see so many examples that extend obviously beyond just purely those kinds of experiences happening in a sexual encounter, but there are so many. In fact, there's been a very big push in research in recent years to study spiritual transformation, and it certainly makes a complete sense to me that sexual experiences, sexual ecstasy, and so forth, can lead very, very easily to a very profound spiritual state or mystical state that can have strong transformative powers. When we look at what goes on in the brain during mating rituals all the way up to what we see in orgasm, it's really, it actually, as I said, it affects the same basic parts of the brain and the body that we see also in religious and spiritual rituals. So
now sorry. Go ahead.
For example, one of the things that we've looked at, and there's been a fair amount of evidence for now, is that when you look at what's happening in the context of the biology of the person's body during religious or spiritual experiences, is that it has a tendency to activate a part of the brain or a part of the body called the autonomic nervous system.
Right.
And this is really a big controller of how the body works. There's an arousal part of that, and then there's a calming or quiescent part of that. We've always hypothesized that at very peak spiritual states that you actually will get a kind of mutual turning on of both this arousal mechanism and also the calming or quiescent mechanism. We see this in the context of deep spiritual states where a person can be intensely alert and aroused and at the same time have this incredible feeling of calmness and blissfulness come over them. On the other hand, what happens during sexual act and ultimately orgasm is that you have to activate both arms of this autonomic nervous system. You really need both parts for the person to actually experience orgasm, and I think it makes complete sense that basically you're saying it's the same fundamental mechanism of activating this autonomic nervous system in a similar manner, and as we said, we were talking about this structure earlier, the autonomic nervous system feeds right into the hypothalamus. So that's part of the ecstatic experience that you get in sexual orgasm as well as in a religious or spiritual orgasm.
It's really interesting because I, about a year ago, maybe it was about a year and a half ago, I had a really fascinating sexual experience. It led to something they call a kriya, where there were involuntary muscular contractions.
Uh-huh.
Which lasted, it lasted for about a month.
Hmm.
I had never heard of this before. It's spelled K-R-Y-A-S, I think.
Oh.
Anyway, I went in search of, has anybody ever been having sex and had this amazing spiritual experience and then have these involuntary muscular contractions afterwards, you know, like a long time afterwards, what's going on here? And I stumbled
right.
across something on the internet that talked about meditation, tantric sex, and speaking in tongues. And how they, all of these experiences seemed to have the potential to produce this hyper state, if you will.
Right.
And then there were some warnings that you wanted to be careful.
but right, well, that's understandable, yeah.
It was the first that I'd heard speaking in tongues and sex mentioned in the same breath, and now you've mentioned that you've done some research on speaking in tongues, and I'm very interested because my grandmother actually was an Assembly of God, and I've been there, you know, they fall down in the aisles.
Sure.
So what did you find?
Well, I mean, one of the areas of the brain that, again, that I think is very important is this frontal lobe that in speaking in tongues, it actually shuts down because the person really is kind of surrendering themselves and giving themselves over to God. And whatever is coming through them, the vocalizations that are coming through them, they're not purposely making them. They're not focusing on them. These are things that are just kind of happening to them. So what we actually see is this very kind of powerful experience where you kind of lose your willfulness, if you will, and you have this feeling of complete surrender over to God, and this can be an extraordinarily powerful experience, and a you know, can be obviously a, you know, as we've been talking all along, it can be a scary experience on one hand, but it could also be enormously positive and wonderful on the other. So it does make sense again that that in the context of all of these different kinds of experiences, and this is actually, I guess, a more general perspective that I've had on all of this, that when we talk about God changing the brain, that it's really all the different parts of the brain that get involved. It's not like there's one little area. I mean, we can talk about one or two particular areas at a particular moment or during a particular practice, but it's really every part of the brain. It just depends on what the person is experiencing. If they feel a sense of surrender, you get one kind of change. If it's an incredible emotional response, you get another kind of change. So all the different parts of the brain, the emotional areas and the cognitive areas and the sensory areas, can all be turned on in different ways depending on what the particular person is practicing and what they are experiencing. So what I've been arguing all along is that there's actually a large network of structures in the brain that are kind of that spiritual network, if you will, and that as you activate them in different ways, you can get a whole variety of different kinds of experiences that are very related. And some of them can be what we would call spiritual. Some of them may be sexual. Some of them may be religious. And part of, I mentioned earlier, one of the studies that we talk about in our book is this online survey to get a sense as to what are people really trying to say? What are people really experiencing and how are they describing it? Because ultimately what our research seems to point to is that there's really probably about 6 billion religions in the world, that, you know, every individual has a slightly different perspective on what these ideas and concepts are, because everybody's brain on one hand has a lot of similarities. We all have the same structures and so forth and the same neurotransmitters, but we also have some fundamental differences.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating thing to me too. I think about some of the things that I've seen that I've thought were definitely miracles, and then somebody else might be there and sitting right next to me, and they would have a totally different perception of the event.
Right, and that was actually, you know, in our last book, Born to Believe, what we were really talking about was how do beliefs affect what we think and perceive about these different experiences. And as you said, and we actually quote someone who had a near-death experience, and, you know, for some people that's an enormously spiritual kind of experience, but for this particular person, they just felt like it was their brain dying. So,
oh, my God.
Because, yeah.
And, no pun intended. Wow.
Right, and so everybody really, you know, takes from these experiences, they go into those experiences with their belief system. And, in fact, I mean, the story I always like to tell is when I was having a conversation with one of my friends who's a very, very staunch atheist, And he said to me, well, you know, look, if God really exists, why doesn't God come down, shake my hand, say, I'm here, I'm God, I run the whole thing, and, you know, believe in me from now on. And he said, if that happened, then I would believe. And I said, no, you wouldn't. You would check yourself into a mental institution right away because you would think that you were crazy. So, you know, just because, you know, how we decide to accept different pieces of information as truth and fact, is can be extremely different from person to person. And in fact, when I am asked a lot of times about, you know, certain atheists who will say, well, there's no evidence that God exists. And I always think, well, you know, that's a very limited way of looking at evidence because evidence, I mean, obviously, yes, we have no scientific evidence, perhaps, but if you go into a church or a synagogue or a mosque on the weekend, you will find lots of people who feel that they have lots of evidence that God exists in their lives. So you can't just say that there's no evidence. It just may not be evidence that you're willing to accept or that you're willing to agree with. And that's also part of this whole issue about how God changes your brain because, you know, part of it has to do with what your belief system is to begin with that determines how the idea of God actually affects you.
What happens when God gets angry?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, when people look at God from a very negative perspective as either a God that has anger, that is a God that doesn't forgive easily, that that can be spiteful and hateful and vengeful and so forth, then that's the kind of God, if you hold those beliefs, that's going to change you into somebody who shares those same kind of ideas and ideals. You're going to be somebody who begins to look at the world and at other people in a very negative way, and it actually fosters a great deal of anxiety and fear in your own brain. So it is something that can be very detrimental. It can be detrimental to you as an individual because you begin to have a great deal of fear and anxiety in your own life. And ultimately, it can be detrimental to society if people decide to act on it and they say, you know what, I have to defend myself. I have to be exclusive and defend my beliefs against others. And so I'm going to, you know, hurt somebody else or fly a plane into a building or whatever. And I think, you know, part of where I think this research ultimately has to go, and we've started to take it there, is what does happen when God gets angry? How do we understand that physiologically in the brain? And can we use that information to perhaps try to find more effective ways of taking people who do have this negative perspective and this hateful kind of perspective and turn it into something positive? And obviously, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that it's something easy to do, but I think it is something that might be possible down the road, but we have to understand it first, and that's really where we are at this point.
Wow. So, you know, we only have a few minutes left, and I think it would be nice for our listeners to get some of the tips that you share with your readers, if you don't mind, about
sure.
What kind of spiritually based practices can improve your mind and your brain.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are actually many different types of things that we can do to help improve our mind and our brain. In fact, what we try to do to some degree is try to distill out, if you will, some of the more classic spiritual type of practices and take from them just kind of their basic elements, which could be used then ultimately in a secular way or in a religious and spiritual way. I think that is important because to some degree, you know, somebody might say, gee, I really just want to do something for stress management so I can feel better. And somebody else may say, I really want to achieve some deeper spiritual state. So we talk about practices in a very broad way, but each of them could be adapted for the purposes that any particular individual might want to pursue. Now, along those lines, I mean, one of the sort of funny ones, but actually turns out to be really quite effective, is yawning. So if you actually, the research has shown that if you actually sort of forcibly yawn a couple of times, obviously everybody knows it's contagious. In fact, the fact that I'm speaking about it at all, probably a few people.
I'm doing it right now.
There you go. And what happens when you yawn? Well, it's your brain's way of waking you up. That's why we yawn when we're tired. It's not that we're expressing being tired. It's actually our brain saying, hey, you got to wake up. So by yawning, you bring in a little bit more oxygen. There's some evidence that helps to kind of cool your brain down a little bit. And that it's through that process that you actually wake up your brain and make you feel a little bit more alert. So if you're about to start a prayer practice or a meditation practice, again, for either spiritual or non-spiritual purposes, it might be interesting to try yawning for a minute or two before you get started, because it might just kind of waken your brain up a little bit. So that's one practice that we talk about, very simple. There are many different kinds of meditation practices. We obviously don't have time to go into all of them, but even just a simple, you know, the most simple one of all is just it's sort of similar to yawning, which is just a simple breathing exercise. And it's something that you can do at your desk at work without people thinking that you're weird. You know, you can just kind of close your eyes, focus on your breath for a couple of minutes, allow your thoughts to just kind of flow through you and flow through that breathing process. It doesn't have to be a very deep contemplative type of meditation, but you can just, by focusing on your breathing for a very short period of time, can relieve some stress, can improve your feelings of anxiety, and maybe some feelings of depression, and just kind of open your mind up and get yourself to kind of get a little bit of new perspective on whatever issues you're dealing with in the day. On the other hand, if you want to really pursue a breath practice for many, many, you know, hours on end, you can induce some very powerful spiritual states as well. So each of them can go either way, but those are some of the practices that we talk about. And then we also talk about, you know, how do you really make your brain healthy and keep it healthy, and really the number one answer to that is to have faith in whether that is to have faith in God or to have faith in a positive outlook in the world, that the world is ultimately, in spite of all of our economic mess, is going to wind up in something good, or that you're going to have a positive, optimistic outlook on life. A lot of research has shown that that kind of having faith in yourself, having faith in the world, having faith in God, can be really one of the best things that you can do for your brain. So, but we also talk about a lot of other ways in which the brain can be enhanced and improved and kept healthy, as well as some specific practices, as you mentioned, and I certainly encourage everyone to look into them in much more detail.
Do you give people any tips on how to explore their own concept of God, like if they're not sure if they believe in God or not?
Well, I think that, what our research shows, that the thing to make your brain the healthiest is to engage it, and the more you can explore, question, read, go to different churches, go to different groups, talk to your friends, read Descartes, as we were talking about earlier, read what the great thinkers and philosophers have done, and not to be afraid of that. You know, each of us, sometimes people say, well, you know, I'm not a philosopher, I'm not going to get all this stuff. Well, that's not, you know, you're not taking it for a class, you don't have to get a grade. It's to take out of it what you can and to allow yourself to think about it. In fact, one of the things that I always hope comes out of the things that I do and talk about is to just give people an opportunity and a language by which they can explore those questions on their own without having to think that, gee, I don't have a PhD in philosophy or theology, so I shouldn't be even thinking about this stuff. That's not true. I mean, everybody has an ability to think about these things. Everybody should engage those kinds of questions. And the more they do, the better it ultimately is for that individual, provided that they don't wind up, as we talked about at the very beginning, in some kind of really existential crisis where you know, you really wind up struggling with the problems. If you feel like you've gotten, you know, that far, then it's time to really make sure that you're talking to somebody who can help guide you through that process. But short of that, the more one can question and engage and focus and do all these different kinds of practices, the better off people will be.
What do you think? Who do you think should be reading your book? You know, you're a neuroscientist. You're really easy to talk to, but is the book easy to read? Is it friendly?
Well, I hope so. I suppose the answer to your question is everyone. everyone should read it.
It's not aimed towards scientists, then.
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's very readable. We actually talk about a lot of fascinating things that we didn't really have a chance to get into. We ask people to draw pictures of God, and we have some pictures in there, and we talk about what that means. We ask a question about what happens when God gets angry. What does God feel like to people? And then we do have a lot of practical information for people as well. So it's really designed for everyone. And even though we're talking about how it affects the brain, and we do talk about a few of the brain parts, that stuff is kept, pretty simple, and it's mostly there to show people that there really are things that are happening, And that, you know, so when you do actually feel a little less stressed or a little bit more spiritual, that that even though there is that spiritual element or that, you know, that emotional element, there's also something that's happening inside of you biologically. So there's something really real happening, and it has very powerful consequences to who you are. So it is something that that really could be available for everyone, and that's really what we wrote the book for.
Well, you certainly have encouraged me to stick with my meditation practice. Where can people get a copy of your book?
They should be able to get it at pretty much any of the, you know, major booksellers and online, of course, Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and so forth. So at the moment, it should be pretty much everywhere.
Okay, and again, the name of that book is How God Changes Your Brain, Breakthrough Findings from a Leading Neuroscientist, and it's by Andrew Newberg and Mark Robert Waldman. And what's the what's your website address?
My website is www.andrewnewberg.com, and people are welcome to go there and explore some of the, you know, if they want to get into the science, the nitty-gritty science of it, there's research articles on there, and you can also look at some of the other things that we've written, other books and so forth, and find out more about what we're doing here at the University of Pennsylvania as well.
Well, I think your work's really exciting, and I hope you'll come back And especially as you do more research, I'd love to have you back to tell us what else you have found out.
I'd be more than happy to.
Okay. Thank you so much for being so easy to talk to. You give science a good name.
Well, thank you. I try to. Thanks very much.
All right. Good night.
Have a good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me.
Yeah.